survived. Piresh was not one of them. The very idea of Theodore Roosevelt on a river that was as remote and unknown as the one that had killed Piresh and his men was enough to make Foreign Minister Müller quickly regret his impulsive suggestion that Roosevelt change his trip. "Now, we will be delighted to have you do it, but of course, you must understand we cannot tell you anything of what will happen," Müller hastened to warn Roosevelt. "And there may be some surprises not necessarily pleasant." If Müller was nervous about Roosevelt's decision to descend an unmapped river, Henry Fairfield Osborne was thunderstruck. The news which Frank Chapman delivered to Osborne after receiving a letter from Roosevelt set off alarm bells at the American Museum of Natural History. Horrified, Osborne immediately sent a blistering message to Roosevelt that he would never consent to his going to this region under the American Museum flag. This was not remotely the journey they had agreed on, and Osborne fumed that he would not even assume part of the responsibility for what might happen in case Roosevelt did not return alive. Roosevelt's admission that his new plan was slightly more hazardous than the original was, according to Frank Chapman, the understatement of the century. "In a word," the bird curator later wrote, "it may be said with confidence that in all South America there is not a more difficult or dangerous journey than that down the River of Doubt." Roosevelt was more than willing to accept that danger for himself, but he would not force his men to do the same. Turning to his naturalists, his secretary, and his old friend Father Zahm, Roosevelt assured them that they were free to leave the expedition if they wished. "If they had the slightest hesitation, I would take them with me to the headwaters of the unknown river and then go down it myself with Colonel Rondon and my son Kermit, and I would send them back with the collections to the Paraguay and then home," he later wrote Chapman. To Roosevelt's surprise, each of the men, even Zahm, who had drafted the original route, agreed to the drastic change of plans. The journey that Roosevelt had lightheartedly described as his last chance to be a boy had suddenly turned into his first chance to be something that he had always dreamed of being, an explorer. The little boy of 6 in the nursery on 20th Street had read with fervent interest of the adventures of the great explorer Livingston, Roosevelt's sister Corrine would later write. He had achieved his ambition to follow those adventures as a mighty hunter in Africa. He had achieved many another ambition, but none was more intense with him than the desire to put the River of Doubt on the map of the world. Roosevelt lived during the last days of the golden age of exploration, a time when men and women of science roamed the world, uncovering its geographical secrets at a breathtaking pace and giving rise to bitter international competitions. The year he was born, the earnest young explorer John Hanning Speke, traveling with the famed Orientalist Richard Burton, discovered the source of the White Nile. In 1909, the year that Roosevelt left the White House, Americans Robert Peary and Matthew Henson won the race to reach the North Pole, the race that had nearly cost Fiala his life and the lives of all his men. Just 2 years later, in late December 1911, Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen became the first man to reach the South Pole. Robert Scott, a renowned explorer and British hero, made it to the pole a month later, only to find the Norwegian colors flapping in the polar wind where he had planned to plant the British flag. Shocked and dispirited, Scott and his men froze to death on their long, bitter journey back to their ship. Sir Ernest Shackleton and his men, in a legendary attempt to cross Antarctica, narrowly escaped the same fate 2 years later, the same year that Roosevelt would set off down the River of Doubt. To Osborne, Roosevelt's decision to descend this river seemed insane, if not suicidal, and he ordered Chapman to tell the former president that the American Museum of Natural History expected him to adhere to his original plan. However, when Chapman's letter, with all the weight of the museum behind it, reached Brazil, it had less effect than a leaf falling in the rainforest. Having found the challenge he had been yearning for, Roosevelt was beyond the reach of Osborne's persuasion. In a letter to Chapman, Roosevelt wrote, "Tell Osborne I have already lived and enjoyed as much of life as any 9 other men I know. I have had my full share, and if it is necessary for me to leave my bones in South America, I am quite ready to do so. Osborne's objection to Roosevelt's new expedition was not only that it would take him through one of the most remote and least known regions of the Amazon rainforest, but that it was based on a sudden decision. The months of planning that had taken place in New York the past summer had been for a completely different kind of journey, one that could not be easily, much less quickly, adapted to fit the new route. Even Roosevelt had to admit that the man he had originally entrusted with planning his Amazon expedition was far out of his league when it came to the descent of the River of Doubt. "Father Zahm is a perfect trump," he wrote to Chapman on November 4th. "But he knows nothing of any of the country which we have planned to go through, and in practice can give us no help or advice as to methods of traveling and what we will or will not be actually able to accomplish." Zahm put on a brave face, writing to his brother Albert that he was "most eager to begin the strictly scientific part of our trip, the exploration of an unknown river and an unknown region." But the abrupt change of plans must have been deeply disappointing. After little more than a week in South America, he was already beginning to lose control of his trip, a journey that he had conceived of, waited 5 years for, and lovingly planned. Zahm must have known that it would be unlikely that he would play a central role in the new expedition, if any role at all. It was becoming apparent to everyone in the expedition that they were not as well prepared for a journey of any kind into the Amazon as they had allowed themselves to believe. One of the most essential items for their trip, the motorboats that Father Zahm had ordered, not only were unsuitable for the new expedition, they would have been inappropriate even for the original route. Brazilians who had traveled in the Amazon took one look at the massive boats and bluntly told Roosevelt that it would be impossible to transport them through the jungle. Also, the provisions that Fiala had so carefully chosen and packed were more of a burden than a blessing in the eyes of the other men on the expedition. When Roosevelt's party reached Buenos Aires, the sheer volume of baggage that was unloaded from the Van Dyke drew a crowd of curious onlookers. There were mountains of crates, guns and ammunition, chairs and tables, tents and cots, equipment for collecting and preserving specimens, surveying the river, and cooking meals. After one of the baggage handlers, soaked in sweat, carried the final item from the steamer to the dock, a customs officer asked him if everything was now accounted for. Mopping his brow, the stevedore replied, "Nothing lacking but the piano," and the crowd erupted in laughter. Even worse for Fiala and Sig, soon after they disembarked, the two men found themselves the lone custodians of this mountain of bags, boxes, and crates. Leo Miller and Cherry promptly excused themselves, explaining that they needed to start doing some collecting, and fled to Asunción, Paraguay, leaving their companions to struggle with what Miller referred to as the expedition's appalling amount of luggage. Roosevelt, for his part, would have no opportunity to help get his expedition on track. From the moment he set foot in South America, he was plunged into a non-stop whirlwind of political commitments and controversies. His speaking tour through Brazil, Uruguay, a last-minute addition, and Argentina would follow a fishhook-shaped course down the Atlantic coast and then westward to Chile, before returning to Brazil and the Amazon. Frankly, Roosevelt was not looking forward to any of it. "I loathe state traveling and speech-making. Ugh," he wrote to his daughter Ethel in early December. He knew that his expedition through the Amazon would be difficult, but he suspected that it would be less unhealthy than a steady succession of dreary banquets and buckets of sweet, tepid champagne. Zahm, on the other hand, delighted in the endless parade of banquets and dinners and basked in the glow of Roosevelt's reflected fame. "As you will see from the papers sent you, I have covered much ground since I wrote you and have been lionized everywhere, notwithstanding the fact that there has been a very big lion with me," he wrote his brother. "If I were young enough to be spoiled, I should now be beyond redemption." The excitement with which Roosevelt was met in nearly every city he visited, in countries whose governments and citizens supposedly feared and hated him, was testimony to Rough Rider's legendary charm. Not everyone in South America admired Theodore Roosevelt, however, and he soon found that his detractors were as loud and passionate in their derision as his supporters were in their praise. Although Father Zahm would later refer to the tour as one continuous ovation, Chile was a notable exception. Students at the university in Santiago disagreed with Roosevelt on several serious issues, not the least of which was the Panama Canal. Roosevelt considered the Panama Canal to be one of the greatest achievements of his presidency, and he believed that the canal's architectural genius and the indelible mark that it, and through it he, would leave on the world more than justified the small South American revolution he had had to foment in order to make it a reality. In 1903, Roosevelt's third year in the White House, the United States government decided, after much heated debate, that Panama, rather than Nicaragua, would be the best location for a canal that would connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. At that time, Panama was a state within Colombia, and so Roosevelt had offered Colombia $12 million for the right to build the canal. When the Colombian Senate countered with restrictive treaty language and a demand for more money, Roosevelt's response was impatience and contempt. He wrote to his Secretary of State, John Hay, that the United States should not allow the lot of jackrabbits in Colombia to bar one of the future highways of civilization, and he proceeded quietly to encourage and support a Panamanian revolution that had been bubbling under the surface for years. On November 3, 1903, with U.S. Navy ships lined up in nearby waters, Panama declared its independence. 15 days later, John Hay and Philippe Bonneau-Varilla, a Frenchman who had been the canal's chief engineer, signed the Hay-Bonneau-Varilla Treaty, which gave the United States control of the canal zone, a 5-mile-wide swath of land on either side of the waterway. A decade later, the Colombians were still fuming. When asked by a Brazilian official why he had left Colombia off his South American itinerary, Roosevelt had replied, "Don't you know, my dear friend, that I am not a persona grata in Colombia?" Although Roosevelt had steered clear of Colombia, he would not be able to avoid a hostile encounter in Chile, where Colombian students had organized protests against him. When his train pulled into Chile's capital, Santiago, in late November, he was greeted by a crowd that at first seemed to mirror the friendly masses that had welcomed him to Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina. But the moment he leapt from his Pullman to the train station floor, with the triumphal strains of the American and Chilean national anthems echoing around him, his welcoming party suddenly transformed into an angry protest rally. The human multitude, showing marked hostility, shouted with all their might, "Vivas!" to Mexico and Colombia, and "Down with the Yankee imperialism," a journalist for Lima's West Coast Leader excitedly reported. The Chilean government went to great lengths to shield Roosevelt from the demonstrations, even buying and destroying newspapers that covered anti-Roosevelt rallies. But their guest had no desire to hide from any assault on himself or his country. On the contrary, he took every opportunity to face down his attackers, ready to explain in no uncertain terms why he was right and they were wrong. At a state reception welcoming him to Chile, he vigorously debated Marcial Martinez, a former Chilean ambassador to the United States, about the continued relevance of the Monroe Doctrine. Days later, in an electrifying speech, he gave an impassioned, utterly unapologetic defense of the Panama Canal. The speech was Roosevelt's last in Chile, and it left the country, if not convinced of Roosevelt's righteousness, at least impressed by his conviction. As soon as he began to advert to the subject, everyone was attention, and the silence that prevailed was almost painful, Zahm later recalled. The large auditorium in which he spoke seemed to be surcharged with electricity, and everyone seemed to be prepared for a shock or an explosion. Everything, the environment, the speaker, the subject, the great historical event under review, was dramatic in the extreme. And everyone felt that it was dramatic. Drama was Roosevelt's forte, and few subjects stirred him to greater emotion than did the Panama Canal. Whatever animosities may have been harbored against him when he began speaking, he had his audience in his pocket by the time he walked out the door. "I love peace, but it is because I love justice and not because I am afraid of war," Roosevelt told the spellbound crowd. "I took the action I did in Panama because to have acted otherwise would have been both weak and wicked. I would have taken that action no matter what power had stood in the way. What I did was in the interest of all the world, and was particularly in the interests of Chile and of certain other South American countries. I was in accordance with the highest and strictest dictates of justice. If it were a matter to do over again, I would act precisely and exactly as I in very fact did act. As these words rang through the hall, the audience leapt to its feet, cheering and applauding the Yankee imperialist. While Roosevelt was distracted from his pending expedition by 1,000 different commitments, his son and young cousin had only one thing on their minds: love. While in Buenos Aires, Margaret Roosevelt had received bunches of white roses every day from Henry Hunt, her admirer from the Van Dyke. Kermit, for his part, was still waiting miserably for a reply to the marriage proposal he had sent Belle a month earlier. He was a confident young man, but Belle had always seemed elusive, and Kermit was far from certain that she would agree to marry him. Not only was he thousands of miles away from her, but he had been so for more than a year. He also was not living in the kind of place that would necessarily appeal to a girl like Belle. While working on the railroad, Kermit had lived in a retired day coach that could barely accommodate him and his few belongings. Perhaps worst of all, in the rural areas where he worked, there was a nearly constant threat of disease. Kermit had had so many recurring bouts of malaria since he had moved to Brazil that the disease had become almost commonplace for him. It would not, however, seem commonplace to Belle, nor did it to Kermit's parents. When Roosevelt had first seen his son in Bahia, he had written to his sister Bammy that Kermit was not in quite as good health as I should like to see him. On the other hand, Roosevelt wrote, "He has matured very much. He earns $2,500 a year, the equivalent of about $45,000 today. Is deeply interested in his work, and it looks as if he has a future." Kermit hoped that that future would be solid enough to impress Belle, but he could not be sure. She was a beautiful, wealthy girl who was surrounded by America's and Europe's most eligible young bachelors. He knew that she could have any man she wanted. What he did not know was whether she wanted him. On November 14th, he finally got his answer. "Dear Kermit, I'm very glad you did send the letter, because I do love you and will marry you. I don't know how or why you should love me, perhaps because I too have prayed and been unhappy, and now you love me and my heart is very full. What have I done that God should choose me out of all this world for you to love? But as he has done this, so perhaps he will make me a little worthy of your love. May he keep you safe for me. I love you, Kermit. I love you. Belle." When Kermit read Belle's reply, all of his worrying, all of the excruciating weeks of waiting were forgotten. He was obliged to attend a formal luncheon and an elaborate dinner that day, but he floated through both events in a joyous fog. "I don't remember a word I said, though I remember all I thought, for I was with you the whole time," he wrote her. "It just seems like a dream, dearest, and I get so afraid that I may wake, for if it's a dream, I want to stay asleep forever." Roosevelt was thrilled for his son. "Kermit is as much in love as anyone could desire," he wrote his daughter-in-law, Eleanor. "And I am pleased beyond measure that he should be about to marry. Belle is a dear girl." Edith, however, seemed less enthusiastic about the match. She remembered Belle from the summer before Kermit left for Brazil, and now that her quiet, serious son was engaged to the young socialite, a girl Edith had nicknamed the Fair One with Golden Locks, she wrote Ethel that she felt a trifle down. Although his mother seemed to have reservations about his impending marriage, Kermit himself had none. He wanted nothing more than to board the next boat to Europe and at long last be reunited with his fiancée. While they were still in Bahia, however, Edith had pulled her son aside at the first opportunity and urged him to take a leave of absence from work so that he could look after his father in the Amazon. Kermit had no interest in joining the expedition, but he felt that he had little choice in the matter. He could see that his mother was worried, and he had to admit that he, too, was concerned about his father's health and safety. Roosevelt had always seemed invincible to his children, as though the great heart in his barrel chest would never stop beating. But the assassination attempt in 1912 had, with a shocking suddenness, changed all of that. Kermit already living and working in Brazil at that time, had been hit perhaps hardest of all by the reality of his father's mortality. "It was a bad time to be far away," he admitted to Bell. "And the way in which I was told didn't help matters. I guess the man must have been worrying how to tell me and got mixed up. He's a big up-from-the-soil sort of foreman, and he looked rather embarrassed and then said, 'Well, I guess that they've shot Roosevelt all right.' It was almost impossible to get anything more out of him. It was exactly like one of those breaking-the-news anecdotes. But it doesn't amuse you very much when it happens to you." Roosevelt had at first welcomed the addition of his son to his expedition, but the news of Kermit's engagement made him hesitate. He did not want Kermit to accompany him on an unavoidably dangerous journey when he had a fiancée who was anxiously awaiting his return. "I did not like Kermit to come on this trip with me," Roosevelt wrote his daughter-in-law Eleanor, "but he did not wish to be married in my absence, and moreover felt that this semi-exploration business was exactly in his line." However, in a letter to Bell, Kermit confessed that he was determined to go on this expedition, not for his own sake, but for his father's, and he would count the days until the journey's end.
"It just doesn't seem as if I could live so long without seeing you, but I feel so very sure that I am doing what you would want me to do," he wrote her. "Yesterday Mother gave me another long talk about Father, and about some other ways I must look after him. She's dreadfully worried about him, and there's nothing for me to do but go."
Kermit's commitment to his father's expedition was painfully tested on November 26th, when he watched his mother and cousin set sail for the Panama Canal from Valparaiso on Chile's Pacific coast. The thought of the months ahead of him without Bell made Kermit miserable. Yet he stood resolutely by his father's side as the ship carrying Edith and Margaret disappeared in the distance.
"We would have both felt that I must go with Father," he wrote to Bell that night. "If I weren't going, I should always feel that when my chance had come to help, I had proved wanting, and all my life I would feel it."
Part 2. Into the Wilderness. Chapter 6. Beyond the Frontier. On the morning of December 12, 1913, Colonel Candido Rondon, 5'3" tall, with dark skin, a shock of black, slightly graying hair and a ramrod straight posture, was looking crisp and starched in his dress whites as he anxiously paced the deck of the Nyoac, a shallow river steamer that was anchored at the juncture of the Paraguay and Apa rivers on Brazil's southern border. Peering into the distance, Rondon searched for a column of smoke, a tall steel mast, anything that would herald the arrival of the Adolfo Riquelme, the Paraguayan president's gunboat yacht that was carrying Theodore Roosevelt to meet him. After almost 2 months in South America, Roosevelt had finally completed his official duties and could now devote himself entirely to his long-anticipated expedition into the Amazon. So remote was the region he had agreed to explore, however, that even getting to the River of Doubt would require a journey of at least 2 more months, first by boat and then on muleback. Crossing into Brazil on the broad Paraguay River, Roosevelt and his men would continue upstream as far as possible, disembarking at a telegraph station and frontier town called Tapirapon. They would then make their way across 400 miles of the Brazilian highlands, passing through open plains, scrub forest, barren desert, and dense jungle to reach the river and launch their boats down its black, fast-moving waters. With every mile of this journey, the expedition would be moving farther from populated areas and closer to the edge of the unknown. Although the initial leg of boat travel offered a last opportunity for relative comfort and safety, the grueling overland journey would take them well past the frontier of settled lands, and into dangerous wilderness regions where the first outposts of military and governmental authority had only recently been established, and where harsh terrain and fierce indigenous tribes still posed a grave threat to intruders. Even for the most hardened, ambitious Brazilian frontiersmen, the territory that Roosevelt was preparing to cross was considered too difficult and dangerous to settle or explore. Indeed, except for indigenous tribesmen, only a handful of men in the history of Brazil had ever reached the headwaters of the River of Doubt and survived to tell the tale. Those men had been led by Candido Rondon. Born in the remote western Brazilian state of Mato Grosso, in a little town called Mimoso, that was 20 miles south of the state's capital, Cuiabá, Rondon had grown up in painful isolation from the rest of Brazil. His earliest memories were of war and irreparable loss. His father, Cândido Mariano da Silva, a caboclo, or man of mixed Indian and European descent, died from smallpox 6 months before his son was born. Just days later, the Paraguayan dictator Francisco Solano López invaded Mato Grosso in retaliation for Brazil's military intervention in the Uruguayan Civil War. Since there were no lines of communication at that time between Mato Grosso and the Brazilian capital, the remote, impoverished people of Mato Grosso could not look to the government for aid. The War of the Triple Alliance, a bloody 5-year war that pitted Paraguay against an alliance of Brazil, Uruguay, run by a puppet government controlled by Brazil, and Argentina, officially began in 1865, the year that Rondon was born. Under constant siege, the people living in Mato Grosso's far-flung towns fled to Cuiabá in search of protection. Rondon's mother, who was one-quarter Torena Indian and one-quarter Bororo Indian, snatched up her infant son and ran. All she found in Cuiabá, however, was the same deadly disease that had killed her husband. In 1867, half the refugees in Cuiabá, roughly 6,000 people, died from smallpox. In the midst of famine, widespread disease, and war, Rondon survived. His mother did not. Survival against great odds was to become a hallmark of Rondon's life, but so too were loneliness and isolation. Orphaned at the age of 2, Rondon was cared for by his grandparents until they too died while he was still a boy. He was then sent to live with his mother's brother, a man who adopted him, gave him his surname, and educated him until, at the age of 16, Rondon moved to Rio de Janeiro. The city must have seemed utterly alien to a young man who had grown up in the backwoods of Mato Grosso. It is no surprise that he gravitated toward the only semblance of a family that was available to him, the Escola Militar, Rio's military school. Rondon, however, was not like the other boys at the military school, and nearly a year passed before he began to feel comfortable there. Even as a teenager, Rondon was serious and driven. He was also poor beyond anyone's understanding. He woke up at 4 a.m. every day to swim in the sea, and was back in his dark room by 5 a.m., studying by the thin light of a whale oil lamp while the other students, most of whom had been out late the night before, burrowed deeper into their beds, dreading the 6 a.m. reveille. Besides his extraordinary discipline, Rondon's extreme poverty and rural background made him an outcast. Too poor even to afford textbooks, he never left campus with the other boys on the weekends, and he was nicknamed the Hairy Brute because he was so awkward in social situations. The earnest young man's isolation was so complete that no one around him noticed that he was starving. Living on a meager diet of rice and beans, and working night and day in an effort to complete a 2-year degree in only 1 year, he became so malnourished that he finally collapsed while descending a flight of stairs on his way to a math class. Rondon lost an entire year of school while he slowly recovered, but he spent the time tutoring other students and never gave up his ambitions for a military career. After returning to school, he earned a bachelor's degree in mathematics and the physical and natural sciences, and while still in his early 20s, was promoted to military engineer, a title that ensured him a lifelong professorship or a well-respected position as an intellectual at the military headquarters in Rio. Positions that would have been the culmination of a dream for many men, especially a poor caboclo from remote Mato Grosso. Rondon, however, had other plans. He wanted to serve not just his country, but its most disenfranchised and endangered inhabitants, the Indians. "I want to bring the civilization which I have acquired to my Mato Grosso and my Amazonia," he said, "to the jungle and its tribes." His determination to protect South American Indians and incorporate them into mainstream Brazilian society, a passion that would come to override all others in his life, grew less out of his ethnic background and his philosophical convictions. Rondon was a member of Brazil's positivist movement, which, founded by the French philosopher Auguste Comte in the mid-19th century, had its foundations in the French Enlightenment and British empiricism. Although positivists claimed to be, as one historian put it, the respectful heirs of Catholicism, the country's dominant faith, their beliefs were in direct contradiction to that religion. Largely a philosophy of humanity, positivism chose scientific knowledge and observed facts over mysticism and blind faith, putting its trust in the inevitable pull of progress, a type of Darwinian evolution toward civilization. Rondon was first exposed to the tenets of positivism while he was a student at the military school. His math teacher, Benjamin Constant, a man known as a mathematical sleepwalker because he could sit for hours in perfect silence, ruminating on the mysteries of math while the chaotic world went on around him, was a vocal member of the movement and did not hesitate to indoctrinate his students. Although he was a personal friend of Emperor Pedro II, Constant, through the military, played a pivotal role in the overthrow of the monarchy and the establishment of the Federal Republic of Brazil in November 1889. After the relatively bloodless coup, Pedro II, like countless fallen monarchs before and after him, sought exile in Paris. The leaders of the Republic created a new flag for Brazil, choosing a green background with a bright blue globe resting on a gold diamond. On the globe they scattered 27 five-pointed stars, one for each of Brazil's states and for the federal district, and stretched a white banner across its face that today still proudly bears the positivist motto, Ordem e Progresso, order and progress, not just for Brazilians, but also for the country's native inhabitants. Less than 6 months after the founding of the Republic, Rondon was given an unexpected opportunity to put his positivist beliefs to work for the good of the Amazonian Indians. He was chosen as the head of the Strategic Telegraph Commission, thereafter known as the Rondon Commission, a job that would put him in direct contact with the Amazon's most isolated tribes. Rondon accepted the assignment and returned to Mato Grosso in April 1890 as a local hero. He was not yet 25 years old, but just 8 years after leaving Cuiabá, he was the commander of a small arm of the military, and he had been entrusted with arguably the Republic's most difficult assignment. The Rondon Commission's expeditions into the Brazilian interior were infamous. At best, they were long, exhausting, lonely treks through unfamiliar territory. At worst, they were terrifying forced marches that subjected the soldiers to disease, starvation, and relentless Indian attacks. Rondon was supposed to have between 100 and 150 men for his expeditions, but he rarely had a full unit. In 1900, Rondon began an expedition with 81 men. By the end of the year, only 30 were left. Of the missing, 17 had deserted, and the rest were either hospitalized or dead. Time passed, and Rondon gained more experience, but the conditions under which his men labored did not improve. In 1903, only 55 men returned from an expedition that had begun with 100. Assignment to Rondon's unit became a punishment, reserved for those enlisted men who had proved themselves to be lazy, violent, or frequently, both. Many of his men were recruited directly from Rio de Janeiro's prisons. Had they known what hardship they would face on one of Rondon's expeditions, most of them would have likely begged to remain in jail. The most harrowing trip that Rondon's men had endured was in 1909, the year that their commander discovered the River of Doubt. He had started out in early June of that year from Tapirapuan, the same town that would serve as the launching point for Roosevelt's overland journey, with 42 men, including two Indian guides. A supply train of 500 oxen and 160 mules was supposed to meet him at the next telegraph station, Juruena, but only 40 animals survived the journey. A few days later, the expedition's geologist and its pharmacist, as well as several military recruits and civilian workers, had to be sent back because they were too sick to travel any farther. Rondon himself was so ill with malaria that the expedition's doctor finally convinced him to ride on an ox. After riding just a quarter of a mile, however, he insisted on walking with his men, explaining later that, "With every step, my self-respect was reduced a little more." In early August, the men, struggling through a dense, tangled jungle that Rondon described as monstrously fecund, stumbled upon a strange, twisting stream. In some places the stream plunged underground. In others it spread out to nearly 40 feet in width. It seemed to flow in a general north-northwest direction, but it twisted so wildly that it was impossible to be sure where it would lead. After following it briefly, the men, their provisions perilously low, gave up. They had neither the strength nor the time to solve the mystery of the river, prompting Rondon to christen it Rio da Dúvida, the River of Doubt. As the men hacked their way through the deepening jungle, their suffering began in full force. By late August, they had exhausted all their supplies and were surviving on Brazil nuts, hearts of palm, wild honey, and an occasional fish. The rivers teemed with piranha, but they sliced through the men's fishing line and hooks with knife-blade teeth. So difficult were they to catch that out of desperation, one lieutenant, a man named Pyrenius, finally threw dynamite into a pond above a waterfall. As he splashed through the water below, eagerly gathering his spoils, he made the mistake of holding a piranha in his mouth while his hands were busy scooping up the others. The fish had at first been stunned by the dynamite, and so lay slack between his teeth. But as soon as it recovered, it attacked. Before Pyrenius had time to react, the piranha had taken a bite out of his tongue. He would have bled to death had the expedition's doctor not stanched the wound with moss. By the time the expedition emerged from the jungle in late December 1909, the men who were still alive were so weak that many of them could hardly crawl. All of them had parasitic insects wriggling under their skin. Those who were not completely naked were wearing only rags, and all were on the brink of starvation. However, over the course of 237 days, they had covered 600 miles of unmapped territory, and Rondon took great satisfaction in the tremendous leap forward that he and his men had made toward the understanding of Brazil's mysterious interior. Then he set about planning his next expedition. Rondon was not, as he later put it, tormented with nervousness, when at 11:30 a.m., the Adolfo Riquelme finally pulled up alongside the Nyoac, and he and his officers stepped aboard the yacht to meet Roosevelt. Although Rondon had spent the better part of the past 25 years in the jungle, frequenting the ministries of the Bororo, Paresi, and Nambiquara Indians, perfecting the etiquette of their respective courts, he was confident that he would know how to greet a former president of the United States. If, when we greet in the Bororo fashion, we are immediately prepared for the sharp odor of naked bodies painted with urucum, he wrote, referring to the pungent red pigment used by Amazon tribes. In compensation, when we exchange amiabilities in the language of Corneille and Molière, we are insensibly drawn to gentleness and refinement. In fact, the language of Corneille and Molière was the only language that Rondon and Roosevelt, now officially co-commanders of the expedition, had in common. Roosevelt had learned only two words of Portuguese, Maish Kanja, which means more soup, and Rondon, although he knew 10 different Indian dialects, did not speak English. Unless Kermit was around to translate, the two men had to rely on French, a language that Roosevelt admitted to speaking, as if it were a non-Aryan tongue, having neither gender nor tense. Despite this barrier, the two colonels seemed to have little difficulty communicating, and by the time their combined party reached the Brazilian river town of Corumbá on December 15th, they had already developed a deep and lasting respect for each other. For Roosevelt, Rondon represented the kind of man he had championed and admired throughout his life, a disciplined officer who thrived on physical challenges and hardship and accomplished great feats through sheer force of will. It would be a measure of his profound respect for Rondon that years later, Roosevelt would count the Brazilian officer among the 4 greatest explorers of his time, alongside Roald Amundsen, Richard Byrd, and Robert Peary. A conspicuous contrast between the two men was in the philosophical conclusions that each drew from his experiences. For Roosevelt, the lessons of nature and human history proved the need to vindicate principles with assertive action, even when that action entailed bloodshed or conflict. Along with that passionate belief in action came a politician's pragmatism, a flexibility in tactics that favored results over process. For Rondon, however, a life spent at the edge of Brazil's frontier and at the margins of its society, had instilled a powerful mistrust of imposed solutions and a determination to respect the workings of law and rationality even when none appeared to exist. In keeping with his positivist beliefs, Rondon did not welcome conflict, but rather sought to avoid it at all costs. Although a military officer, Rondon approached his duties with a pacifist's idealism that would ultimately secure him a place not merely as Brazil's greatest explorer, but as one of its pioneering social thinkers. Devotion to their principles would become part of the legend of both Roosevelt and Rondon. Both had developed their beliefs over a lifetime of experience and thought, and both would be remembered for the passion with which they put those beliefs into practice. From the very beginning, however, their contrasting approaches and personalities ensured that the newly renamed Roosevelt-Rondon scientific expedition would reflect its leaders' powerful and divergent views about life and leadership. The beliefs of both men, moreover, would soon be put to the test on the River of Doubt. Corumbá, the town in which Miller, Cherry, Fiala, and Sig had been waiting for Roosevelt for 3 weeks, was larger than most along the Paraguay River. Cherry had been impressed by his first glimpse of the town, seeing it bathed in the early morning sunshine, the red-tiled roofs and white walls in pleasing contrast to the rich green of banana trees and the fronds of waving palms. It had not taken long, however, for the romance to wear thin. Although Corumbá, which had been founded as a military outpost in 1778, had 10,000 citizens, it did not have streetcars or even hireable carriages. For ambulance service, Cherry noted, a hammock was swung from a long pole that was borne on the shoulders of a couple of porters. After a side trip to a nearby ranch where Roosevelt hunted jaguars, the Nyoac left Corumbá on Christmas Day 1913. It was a brilliantly clear day, Roosevelt wrote. We sat on the forward deck, admiring the trees on the brink of the sheer riverbanks, the lush, rank grass of the marshes, and the many water birds. The two pilots, one black and one white, stood at the wheel. Colonel Rondon, Red Thomas Akempis, Kermit, Cherry, and Miller squatted outside the railing on the deck over one paddle wheel and put the final touches on the jaguar skins. Fiala satisfied himself that the boxes and bags were in place. It was probable that hardship lay in the future, but the day was our own, and the day was pleasant. Rondon had gone to great lengths to try to manufacture Christmas cheer, even sending his men to gather palm leaves and other greenery along the shore so that they could decorate the boat. His American guests, however, could not help feeling homesick. What a Christmas Eve, Cherry had written in his diary the night before. Could anything be less Christmas-like? How I wish I might be at home tonight. Kermit confessed in a letter to Bell that he was not feeling a bit Christmassy either. He missed her, he missed civilization, and he was worried about his father, who he feared had gotten in over his head, a situation for which he blamed Father Zahm. The priest is a foolish, well-meaning little fellow, who misled Father greatly as to the conditions of travel and life down here, he wrote. He had never been off the beaten track, and saw everything through a golden haze. The Nyoac chugged along at a sluggish pace, leaving the men little choice but to settle back on the side-wheel steamer, jammed tight with men, dogs, crates, and reeking animal skins, and spend the next few weeks getting to know the land and one another. Everyone aboard the Nyoac, with the exception of Kermit, was understandably curious about Roosevelt. He had already surprised them by being warm and affable, more interested in hearing about their achievements and ambitions than in talking about his own. But they, like the men who had planned Roosevelt's speaking tour, knew his reputation for physical vigor, and must have wondered if now, at the age of 55, he could still live up to it. It was not long before they had their answer. Not only could Roosevelt withstand extreme tests of physical endurance, but he relished them, to the distress of anyone who was unfortunate enough to be along for the ride. In the White House, Roosevelt used to torture the members of his cabinet with long point-to-point walks through Rock Creek Park, the enormous forested park that runs through Washington, D.C. The walks went on any time of day or night and in any season. On several occasions, we thus swam Rock Creek in the early spring when the ice was floating thick upon it, Roosevelt remembered. If we swam the Potomac, we usually took off our clothes. I remember on one such occasion when the French ambassador, Jules Jusserand, was along, and just as we were about to get in to swim, somebody said, "Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Ambassador, you haven't taken off your gloves." To which he promptly responded, "I think I will leave them on. We might meet ladies." 5 years after leaving the White House, Roosevelt still had the endurance of a man half his age, and he proved it on New Year's Day, 1914. After a 5 a.m. breakfast of sardines, ham, coffee, and hardtack, Roosevelt, Kermit, some Brazilian officers, and a handful of camaradas, the Portuguese word for comrades and the name given to poor laborers in Brazil, headed out for a jaguar hunt near the banks of the São Lourenço, a small river that the Nyoac had steamed into the day before. This was Roosevelt's second jaguar hunt, but it would later become emblematic among the Brazilians aboard the Nyoac as the true measure of the former American president. Anthony Fiala, who witnessed the hunting party's mounting exhaustion from the expedition's base camp along the river, would never forget that day. He later told a reporter for the New York Times, "We did not hear from the party until late in the afternoon, when a big Indian came running into camp shouting, 'Buru Guru Haru,' which meant plenty work, tired. He fell down in a corner and went to sleep. 20 minutes later, another Indian ran in, apparently all used up. He said, 'Guru Haru,' and went to sleep. The third Indian arrived and said, 'Haru,' as he threw up his arms and went off into a trance. This caused me to become anxious about the safety of the colonel and his son, and we started to look for them, as it was getting toward sundown. After walking through the forest for a short distance, we came to a small open space, where we found one of the Brazilian officers lying on the ground, so dead tired that he could go no further. His clothes were torn, and his face and neck were covered with dust and blood. Leaving him in the care of three of the natives to carry him back to the camp, I pushed on farther, and in another clearing I saw Colonel Roosevelt and Kermit dragging the other Brazilian officer after them through the jungle. I shall never forget the awesome appearance of the intrepid colonel as the falling rays of the sun streamed through the trees and lit up his dusty and begrimed features. His clothes were torn to tatters, and Kermit was in the same condition, but had not his father's warlike look. I called out to him, 'Are you all right, Colonel?' And he replied, 'I'm bully,' and then went to camp with the used-up officer. Next day, the colonel and Kermit were about the camp as if nothing had happened out of the ordinary. But the Brazilians were laid up for 2 days. The Indians regarded the colonel with awe after that trip. Chapter 7. Disarray and Tragedy. When the expedition reached Tapirapuan just before noon on January 16th, Roosevelt stepped off his boat expecting to find a well-organized army of oxen and mules prepared to carry heavy loads and make a quick departure for the River of Doubt. To his amazement and dismay, what awaited him in the little riverside village was not military precision, but utter chaos. Set into low scrub forest on the river's edge, Tapirapuan consisted of little more than a collection of small, mud-walled huts and a central square flanked by the offices of the Rondon Commission. It had been swathed in bunting, colorful flags from all the countries of North and South America, and even Chinese lanterns, in celebration of Roosevelt's arrival. However, if Tapirapuan bore a festive outward appearance, Miller wrote, it acted merely as a mask to cover up the general confusion that even a casual inspection could not fail to disclose. Among a scattering of wagons, carts, and telegraph line trucks, a variety of animals, from oxen to mules to milch cows and beef cattle, wandered, Roosevelt wrote, almost at will. Rondon had arranged ahead of time for 110 mules and 70 pack oxen to be on hand for the expedition's overland journey. He had also put Captain Amilcar Botello de Magallanes, a trusted friend who had traveled with him on several previous expeditions, in charge of the baggage train. The problem was that the Americans had brought with them much more baggage than Rondon had expected. Rather than risk embarrassment by explaining the situation to Roosevelt, the colonel scrambled to find additional animals. Although extra mules and oxen were located, they were far from tame. Amilcar, despite his extensive experience with pack animals, had little control over his wild, willful charges. Most of the animals were apparently fresh from the ranges and had never been broken to work of any kind, Miller observed. The corrals reminded one of a Wild West show. Gauchos wearing fringed leather aprons and wicked, keen-edged knives in their belts, and who swore fluently in two or three different languages, lassoed the panicky animals, blindfolded them, and adjusted the packs. When the covering was removed from the animals' eyes, they frequently gave a few sharp snorts, and then started through the corral in a series of rabbit-like leaps, eventually sending the packs, saddles, and all flying in every direction. Roosevelt and his men had expected to stay in Tapirapoan for only one or two days. They quickly realized, however, that they would not be leaving any time soon. Miller and Cherry did not mind the delay because it gave them an opportunity to collect more specimens. Father Zahm, too, was constantly engaged in congenial occupations, and so relatively content. Kermit, however, had no patience with the bumbling antics that layered day after day onto his already unbearable absence from Bell. As he watched the camaradas struggle to control the animals, he silently seethed. The oxen aren't used to be carrying packs and won't let themselves be loaded, and when they are loaded, they buck until they fall down or throw off the packs, he railed in a letter to Bell. I have been ready to kill the whole lot and all the members of the expedition. Perhaps the only man as anxious as Kermit to get to the River of Doubt and get home was Roosevelt himself. Although the opportunity to descend an unmapped river had seemed exciting and adventurous when he was in Rio de Janeiro, it now paled in comparison with what was happening on the world stage. While Woodrow Wilson was making high-stakes decisions about the United States' role in the Mexican Revolution, Roosevelt was headed into one of the few places left on Earth where his opinions would go unheard. Since taking office, Wilson had been doing his best to stay out of Mexico, but it had not been easy. The country's current president, Victoriano Huerta, once the commander of the federal troops, had achieved his position nearly a year earlier by arresting and, a few days later, ordering the assassination of the acting president, Francisco Madero. Repelled by tales of Huerta's ruthless and repressive regime, Wilson determined to help remove him from power by diplomatic means. Intervention must be avoided until a time comes when it is inevitable, which God forbid, he told his wife. After sending two envoys in unsuccessful attempts to persuade Huerta to step down, Wilson had announced that United States policy toward Mexico would consist of watchful waiting. Such a passive policy was anathema to Roosevelt, who was constitutionally incapable of watchful waiting. As he had made clear in his 1912 campaign speech at Madison Square Garden, his ambition, more personal even than political, was to smite down wrong. With the political situation in Mexico continuing to unravel, Roosevelt, Rondon noticed, walked around Tapirapoan in a state of constant preoccupation. At a time when he should have been preparing for the expedition before him, Roosevelt was distracted by a situation that was beyond his control and thousands of miles away. To Roosevelt's growing frustration, the expedition remained practically immobile. Not only were the pack animals recalcitrant, but the already massive amounts of baggage, 360 enormous boxes and countless smaller ones, had been increased significantly by a set of beautiful, elaborate, and completely impractical gifts that the Brazilian government had waiting for the former American leader in Tapirapoan. Roosevelt's only success in speeding up the expedition's departure was to convince Rondon to divide the nearly 200 pack animals into two separate detachments. Roosevelt and Rondon would lead the mule train, and Amilcar would lead the larger baggage train, made up of both mules and oxen. On January 19th, the baggage train at last set off across the Brazilian highlands, with the camaradas that Rondon had hired in Tapirapoan, porters and future paddlers, and most of the expedition's baggage, including the provisions that Fiala had packed in New York, as well as his Canadian canoes, drawn on a cart pulled by 6 oxen. Amilcar's early departure would help give the overburdened baggage train a head start on the mules, which would doubtless be moving at a much faster pace. But Rondon also wanted Amilcar and his men to ride ahead of the mule train so that they could remove any obstacles from the telegraph road and repair any sagging bridges that might impede Roosevelt's progress. The expedition's route called for the men on muleback to follow the supply train north until they reached an outlying telegraph station in Utiariti, where they would turn west and travel for another month until they encountered the dark, snake-like upper reaches of the River of Doubt. They were still in the state of Mato Grosso, but they were now crossing a corner of a vast, ancient plateau known as the Brazilian Highlands. These highlands encompass 580,000 square miles, more than twice the area of Texas. But they were once even larger still. For millions of years, the Brazilian highlands were connected to the Guiana highlands in the north, and were separated only after the Amazon River formed 12 million years ago, splitting the enormous contiguous plateau into northern and southern halves. The crystalline massifs of both plateaus thus rank among the oldest rock formations on Earth, dating back to the Precambrian era, billions of years ago. In fact, the Brazilian highlands are so ancient and have endured such extensive erosion that the highest elevation on the plateau is less than 10,000 feet, half the height of the tallest mountains in the geologically young Andes, and their jagged expanse is marked by steep cliffs, deep ravines, and rolling hills. The highlands, as Roosevelt soon learned, are as varied as they are vast. On the first day out of Tapirapoan, the expedition passed through an open pasture land that was dotted with widely spaced trees. On the second day, the men plunged into dense tropical jungle. Away from the broad, beaten route, every step of a man's progress represented slashing a trail with the machete through the tangle of bushes, low trees, thorny scrub, and interlaced creepers, Roosevelt wrote. By the next morning, however, the mule train had climbed a steep slope into the cool, dry air of a high plateau that rested roughly 2,000 feet above sea level, a region that the Brazilians refer to as Chapadao, or tableland. The men were surprised by the region's aridity, its conspicuous lack of wildlife, even mosquitoes, and the nights that turned so cold that for the first time since beginning their journey, they had to wrap themselves in blankets while they slept. In the early 20th century, modern maps of the Brazilian highlands, drawn up by the world's most respected and experienced cartographers, were strikingly wrong. The whole region, Lauro Müller, Brazil's Minister of Foreign Affairs, had told Roosevelt, would have to be remapped after the discoveries of the Telegraph Commission. It was in exploring the Brazilian highlands that Rondon and his men had lost all their oxen and had nearly starved to death. Rondon knew the region better now, but it was no more settled or welcoming to travelers than it had been on his first journey across it. In fact, his knowledge of the highlands only served to underscore for Rondon how difficult and dangerous their journey to the River of Doubt would be. Within days of leaving Tapirapoan, Roosevelt and the rest of his men could for the first time clearly see signs of the hardships that lay ahead of them. Although they were still hundreds of miles away from the River of Doubt, the fabric of their expedition was beginning to unravel. The men were already obliged to get by with much simpler and less frequent meals. "Until Tapirapoan, our food was abundant, very good, and quite varied," the expedition's Brazilian doctor wrote. "Nevertheless, due to the conditions of the backland, we presently had to change the eating habits we had heretofore adopted, despite the great interest Colonel Rondon had placed on providing our guests with the same privileges granted to them up to that time. Meals usually consisted of fresh meat from one of the oxen, black beans, rice, biscuits, and coffee. But in an effort to save provisions as well as time, Rondon had ordered that their midday meal be omitted completely. Breakfast was served any time between 6 and 8 a.m., but then the men did not eat again until 8 p.m., at the earliest, and on some nights not until 11 p.m.